Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg, that's me, ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
It's 3 o'clock somewhere. Time for a My Mochi ice cream snack. My Mochi ice cream is cool, creamy scoops of premium ice cream wrapped in sweet, pillowy dough. And get this, all of My Mochi's fabulous flavors like strawberry, mango, double chocolate, and cookies and cream are only around 80 calories per piece. Talk about a guilt-free, indulgent experience. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned, gluten-free mochis that are great for grab-and-go. So feel good while curbing your afternoon cravings or the midnight munchies. Yeah, you know who you are with the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream. Find My Mochi ice cream at Target or visit MyMochi.com to locate a grocery store near you.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you can have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here with another edition of the Ion Travel Podcast. This week, 3 different perspectives on the travel industry during hard times. My conversation with Keith Barr, CEO of one of the largest hotel groups in the world, Intercontinental, and his global perspective on the hospitality business. Then I'll look at the billions of dollars the airlines have been holding back. That's right, billions in refunds due to passengers for flights the airlines themselves canceled during the COVID-19 crisis. Scott McCartney of the Wall Street Journal has the hard numbers. And then, my chat with Food Network judge Troy Johnson on the current state of affairs in the restaurant business and what chefs and owners are doing to avoid extinction. First up, Keith Barr. My next guest has lived all over the globe. He's been in Asia. He's been in the Middle East. He's now in the UK. He also happens to be the CEO of Intercontinental Hotels. His name is Keith Barr. Keith, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me here. And by the way, fantastic support you're doing for food banks, and we're doing the same thing around the world. And it's such an incredibly important thing to do to support communities. So well done. I'm really, really, it's great to see that.
Yeah, especially now. You know, I wanted you to come on the show, Keith, because depending on the metric that you use, you could be considered the largest hotel group in the country, in the world.
Yeah, I mean, we've got in 100 countries and territories around the world, 6,000 hotels, 850,000 hotel rooms, and another probably 250,000 in development. So we're sort of everywhere that there are hotels and where you want to be. So we are global and we are big.
And it's not just Intercontinental, of course. The brand that so many people recognize because they've stolen the towels is Holiday Inn.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of it's the brand that kind of set up travel for mainstream America and then later on the world. So Holiday Inn, an incredibly iconic brand, which is probably even more important today, considering how travel has evolved during this pandemic with people moving to doing the Great American Road Trip all over again, which is how Kevin Wilson founded the Holiday Inn brand. And we've kind of see that resurgence again of people traveling in cars across the United States.
But the green and white towels are gone, aren't they?
They are gone, you know, but there are a few out there. And I think you may probably have one at home as well. And I think that we have quite a few in our archives as well. But they are great memories that we all reflect upon fondly.
Well, let's get beyond towels here and talk about the serious stuff. We're dealing with how the world is emerging from this, how it's coping, how it's adjusting, how you had to pivot. I mean, almost overnight, you know, it went from 60 to zero, right? It was like shut down. And how are you coming back? And what are you doing to come back?
Yeah, I mean, sort of, you know, we have been through 9/11, we've been through the financial crisis and financial disasters and tsunamis, and we've never faced anything like this as an industry. And it's been incredibly challenging. And I think where I say we are today is we're recovering, we're resilient, but it's tough out there. You know, we now have about 95% of our hotels open globally. Most of our hotels were open up in the United States, and we're seeing travel begin to come back. But clearly it's challenged by whether it's country closures, restrictions between state-to-state travel in the United States, social distancing measures. So the industry is recovering, but it's a really, really tough time. And, you know, we're trying to do everything we can to make sure our guests feel safe, our colleagues are safe, and that we're working to support our businesses around the world.
Now, obviously, you and every other hotel brand have come up with some very specific and high-tech, you know, cleaning protocols, disinfecting protocols, and obviously behavioral protocols.
Yeah, you know, it's you know, we had great standards in place beforehand with the IHG Way of Clean. We had worked with world-class companies like Ecolab and Diversey to make sure we're using the same chemicals that are used effectively in hospitals. But then we reached out to the Cleveland Clinic, a world-class leader in understanding kind of pathogens and things like that. And they're saying, how can we enhance our protocols and making sure we're doing all the right things in our hotels? And that's what we've really been focused on, is making sure that we're operating our hotels in a way that is safe for our colleagues, safe for our customers, and enabling people to have still a great experience. But it's a challenge to be very open about that. You know, I traveled recently to one of our hotels in France, and they did an amazing job. And you're seeing how hard our colleagues have to work where, you know, wearing personal protective equipment, socially distancing, how we're changing how restaurants operate, what we've had to take out of guest rooms, which are high-touch items, and the additional cleaning we're putting in too. But, you know, we're trying to make sure that all of our guests around the world have a safe experience and a good experience as they want to begin to travel.
You know, one of the unintended byproducts of what you took out of the hotel room is very pleasing to me. You got rid of all the tent cards, all the paper.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. So speaking of that, I was in France, and you know, you walk into, I brought my wife and my two daughters, and I wanted to experience it as a guest and see what are our hotels like. And you walk in the room, and a lot of the clutter was gone, but there were QR codes in many places. And I brought my phone out and scanned the QR code, and there was the room service menu. There was the guest services directory. And it really made me think and talk to our teams about going, should any of this come back in? Reality is, in the day and age of digital and the day and age of mobile, can we be more sustainable by taking things that are basically disposable out of rooms, high touch, and do it a different way too? And so I think that you'll see that is the future of what's going to happen in hotels, is that it'll be much more digital, much more mobile oriented going forward, and a lot less clutter in the rooms.
You know, right before the pandemic, I'm sure you're a part of this, hotels started shifting away from those individual plastic bottles of shampoo and conditioner and body lotion and replacing them with like wall units in the actual showers with larger dispensers. I would assume at this point that's not working.
We're trying to determine that because there's a huge push still for environmental sustainability and how do we make sure we have less impact on the environment, but do it in a way that is safe in a COVID time frame. And so, you know, we're still pushing ahead on it, honestly, Peter, saying we should be moving to bulk amenities because it's less impact on the environment, but making sure that we're having the right cleaning procedures in place and the right sustainability procedures in place to go forward, too. So It is a tension point, though, to be very honest with you. People are talking about you're wrapping more things in plastic now, and is that good for the environment? I'm like, well, it's not, but we're also taking things out of the rooms that were there before. And so how we balance out those two things, because I think the environmental agenda is critically important going forward. And so we have to make sure we can do that in the right way.
Exactly. Now, you know, you talk about most of your hotels being open, but the occupancy is still not high.
No, I mean, so it varies around the world. You know, I was talking to our team in China the other day, and China's almost back to normal, to be very open. You know, it's sort of, you know, they contain the virus quite well.
Hey, they're having pool parties in Wuhan now.
Pool parties in Wuhan. We're having record occupancies in resorts. You know, it really kind of, you know, it's kind of almost back to normal. And which is quite encouraging, right? It shows what people want to do. People want to travel for business and leisure. I was speaking to the team the other day. They were flying up from Shanghai to Beijing. All the flights were full, and it was business people traveling. And so it will show that it will come back when the virus is contained. The challenge is the virus isn't contained in most of the world, right? It's in varying situations in varying places. And so as we get more control, as therapeutics improve, and when a vaccine comes, it does give you confidence that occupancies and travel will come back, because it's an inherent need. People want to travel. We saw that once restrictions got lifted, and also the people want to connect. So, you know, I'm much more confident about the future, about things getting like whether it's 2022, 2023, looking more 2018, that's the reality. I mean, we will get back to where we were. It's just going to be a bit of a challenging time between now and then.
And then the question, of course, becomes, can you financially survive at 25% occupancy until that point happens?
So if you look at our state now, the U.S. is pushing kind of now, because our extended stay portfolio is running kind of about 70% occupancy. Our mainstream hotels are running 50%. So the bulk of our hotels, the Holiday Inns, the Holiday Inn Expresses, and so forth in the U.S., are at a level that's quite sustainable. The real challenge is going to be urban and also big box kind of convention, exhibition, yeah, hotels.
They're going to be struggling for a while.
Yeah, that's one of the real challenges that the industry is going to face. You know, how do groups, meetings, events, conventions, exhibitions come back in a COVID environment? And I think that we're all trying to sort through that. We can understand how small meetings take place, and we're seeing those already start to happen. It's the big gatherings, and I think that's going to be a real challenge for the industry. And also, I mean, you know, places like New York, you know, we're already seeing a number of hotels in New York decide that they're just not going to reopen.
And we've seen that. And that brings me up to my next item up for bids here on The Price is Right. And that's, most people don't realize, consumers don't realize, that even though they recognize the Holiday Inn brand and the Intercontinental brand or Marriott, Hilton, Hyatt, whatever, most of your companies are management firms. And not everybody has equity in the buildings that they're managing. And so your real challenge, of course, is to deal with the owners and their financial stability, because they're really hurting in many cases. If you look at the foreclosure notes, the percentage about a year ago, which would be normal, by the way, of hotels that might be facing foreclosure was something ridiculously low, like 1.8%. Today, the number of hotels where the owners have missed debt service and they haven't made their payments is over 22%. That's a little scary.
It's a big issue for the industry. And, you know, when this all started, I talked to our teams around the world and said, we've got a number of constituents out there. We've got customers, colleagues, owners, shareholders, and government. And how, at the end of this, do we do the right thing? How do we manage that? And so with our owners, like, for example, we cut some of our fees. We gave them release on capital spending. We gave them relief on payment terms and so forth. So we've really been focusing on the liquidity of our owners in the thousands of hotels around the world, because, I mean, we have thousands and thousands of owners of these hotels. And how do we help them get through this? Because we want to be seen as being part of the solution, again, being doing the right thing. And so that's been critical, Peter, from the day one for us, of how do we help all these owners get through it and support them the way we can, because we've got a big balance sheet. We're a big global company, and enabling them to kind of weather the storm. And I think we've done a good job. I mean, you kind of look at the U.S. now, where our ownership base is now, the vast majority of them, you know, they're at a place now where the hotels are operating, they're covering their debt service, they're paying their bills, and they're employing people, which is critically important, because this industry employs 1 in 10 people globally in hospitality and tourism, and it's critically important to job creation. And so we're trying to make sure that we're helping make that continue to go forward and be, again, part of the solution.
And, of course, there's the consumer aspect of all this. I'm sure you saw the story that ran earlier this week when United Airlines announced that for the first time in recent memory, they were going to permanently get rid of those dreaded draconian ticket change fees, and then American and Delta followed suit. Are you doing similar things at Intercontinental where you're not going to give people cancellation fees, or you're going to cut them some slack on reservations?
Yeah, we did that months and months ago, where we basically said we want people to be able to book with confidence, because we recognize that people want to travel, but things are constantly changing. You know, I live here, you know, I grew up in the U.S., but now I'm living here in the U.K., but every week something changes here. I can go to Portugal 1 week, I can't go next week. I can go to France 1 week, I can't go next week. People want to be able to book with confidence. And so what we've said is, you can book your reservations, don't worry about cancellation now, because we want to make sure that you have the opportunity to travel if you can, and which is good for you personally and for your well-being and for your family. But don't worry about cancellations, too. So we did that a long time ago, and we're very committed to that. And we will continue to be, too, because what we really want to do is enable people to travel, because it is such a good thing for people personally and professionally. But we also don't want to make sure that it creates any stress in people's lives now, because there's enough stress out there.
And, you know, when you take a look at business travel being essentially more abundant in many cases, the really hope, at least in the short term, is to generate and stimulate leisure travel. And you got to give people a reason to go in an uncertain time when, as you said, things can change.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was amazed at the pent-up demand in leisure travel around the world. You know, you saw that once restrictions lifted, people were desperate to go on holiday, desperate to take that vacation. But they wanted to do it on their terms. So we saw, again, the Great American Road Trip take place in the U.S. You know, I saw many a Facebook post from my friends from university with their kids who were in high school driving, doing national parks and going to lakes, you know, and wanting to do that. And we've seen that happen around the world, that people do really want to travel from a leisure standpoint. Long haul is going to be tough, Peter, because people are a bit more concerned about getting on a 10-hour, 12-hour flight going someplace. But it will come back, right? I mean, because I know that, you know, you and I love to see the world. We love to meet people, experience cultures, and it will come back. And we were in a record period of time for this industry before the pandemic, and I have to remind people about that, and it will come back. We will be back.
You know what? If you want me to come back to a Holiday Inn, you got to bring back the green and white towels. You got to promise me.
I know you love those towels. I know. So I probably have to have them specially printed just for you at some point.
Keith Barr, everybody, the CEO of Intercontinental Hotels. Keith, thank you so much for joining us, and you can go to bed now.
Thanks, appreciate it. It's a bit late here, so, but great to talk to you as always.
My thanks to Keith. There's a pretty good chance you might have had a scheduled flight between last March and right now, and an equally good chance that that flight was canceled, or the country where you were headed closed their airspace, or someone got sick. You should get a refund, right? Well, that's not what happened to thousands of American passengers. And Scott McCartney, travel editor of the Wall Street Journal, did some digging.
I am inundated still with the after effects of COVID-19 airline ticketing from so many of my listeners complaining that they have an inability. They've had an inability after many, many tries to get the airlines to refund their money on tickets that they purchased in good faith, where flights were canceled, never operated, countries closed, and they're not going anywhere, and they just wanted their money back. We're talking not just a little money out there, we're talking billions, that's right, with a B. And the person who's kept tabs on that is our good friend, one of our regulars on this show, as well as our weekly series on public television called The Travel Detective. He's the travel editor of the Wall Street Journal, Scott McCartney. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Peter.
So it's billions, right? We're talking a lot of money out there.
Yeah, no, it really is. It is billions. And it's significant. It's significant for consumers. It's significant for how people are going to view airlines and travel companies going forward. And what's really been startling to me is the underhanded things that airlines have done. I talked to one family that, you know, thousands of dollars in these tickets on Alitalia. And Alitalia, they called the airline twice to cancel. The airline didn't officially cancel them because Italy wasn't closed yet, and then Italy was closed. They didn't go, but the flight operated and Alitalia marked them as no-shows and said they were entitled to nothing, no voucher, no refund, nothing. And you know, it's just ridiculous. Air Canada is another one. I think just like a lot of airlines, just flouting U.S. law by saying we're not going to pay any attention to it.
Let me ask you this,
Scott.
It's
not fair to consumers.
It isn't. Let me ask you this. You mentioned the Alitalia example. Was that ever resolved?
It was resolved because I got involved. And Alitalia responded by saying, we've changed our policy, and now they are entitled to vouchers. And that's all the family wanted, because they, you know, they do plan to go. But it does make me crazy that you know, sometimes it takes you getting involved, it takes me getting involved, for people to sort of get what's coming to them. And that's not fair to everyone else, and it's no way to treat your customers.
I agree. And, you know, it's interesting. The airlines have not practiced great proactive communication when they're either canceling a flight or rebooking a flight, which, by the way, by definition, is a cancellation.
Yeah, and some of this, again, has been really underhanded. United was one in particular that was sending communications to people saying, you need to change your travel plans right away, and they even set some deadlines. Well, they were pressuring people into making decisions about whether to cancel or not before the airline had actually changed its schedule, and they were holding off on schedule changes because if the airline canceled flights, then they'd have to give everybody a refund. If the traveler canceled, and then they'd be entitled to a voucher. So there was all this pressure for the traveler to be proactive to cancel before you really knew the full story of what the airline was going to do.
And, you know, you mentioned Air Canada. That is now in the courts in Canada. And just to, you know, to update everybody, any airline flying to the United States, foreign or domestic, any airline flying within the United States, most likely domestic, if they cancel your flight under the current U.S. Department of Transportation rules, you are entitled to a full refund back to your original form of payment, even if what you had purchased was a non-refundable ticket. In the case of Air Canada, so many of their flights did start in the United States or were coming to the United States, so they would basically be under that DOT jurisdiction. They then argued, no, we're not going to listen to the United States. We're under Canadian rules where we could just offer you a voucher. And the U.S. Department of Transportation has not done an enforcement action on Air Canada, but Air Canada now is in court in Canada, which who knows how long that case is going to last.
Yeah, I think there's a broader issue here because you described this perfectly, and it applies to a lot of things besides refunds. Safety, for example. When an airline flies to the United States, it has to live up to U.S. safety regulations. And if the new norm is, home rule is all that matters, then I think that has really broad implications for travel. I mean, I think there's a lot more at stake here that the U.S. Department of Transportation is not enforcing and is not holding airlines accountable to. And I really think they need to step it up. And, you know, with Air Canada said, well, the Canadian Department of Transportation says we can ignore the U.S. Well, there's no other example in U.S. foreign policy where another country just gets to say we're going to ignore U.S. law when we're operating in the U.S.
Exactly. And the problem is that, you know, the current philosophy, if I can be so bold, of the U.S. Department of Transportation is to be a part of a continuing mood of anti-regulation. So the problem is they haven't really done it enforced. They sent letters saying, could you please be nice, you know, or could you please remember our rules? When was the last time you got pulled over for speeding and the police officer said, could you just please remember our rules? You get a ticket.
That's exactly it. And in this case, they don't need new regulations. They just need to enforce what's already there, what's already on the books. You know, and it's not like they don't know what's going on. They did send out the warnings. They have been completely inundated with complaints from U.S. consumers, and you know, this is not a small thing. There are families with $5,000, $6,000, $10,000 tied up in tickets that they should get their money back, and they're not. There are folks who have paid for trips that they will never take. They'll never, you know, conferences abroad that they're just never going to end up using those tickets. And we should add, and part of that, I think another problem in the industry is that the vouchers that airlines have been issuing come with all kinds of strings attached to them. I talked to one guy who had bought a family trip to St. Thomas. I think there were 14 different tickets, including for a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old, and the vouchers go to the passenger, not the person who paid for it. He wanted to use all that money for a trip he and his wife were taking, a long international trip, and instead American, in this case, said, no, the 3-year-old gets $400, and the 5-year-old gets a $400 voucher. And eventually, I reached out to American on his behalf, logic prevailed, and they said, you know, this really is stupid. We're going to make an exception for this guy. You know, he had gone through the normal channels and been rejected, just like everybody else.
I mean, God forbid logic should get in the way.
Yes.
But here's the other thing. For many of our listeners, you know, they don't have that many options. They can dispute the charge on their credit card bill if they do it within a certain amount of time, and that time is basically expired by now. So the other option that they have, again, we have to deal with statutes and limitations, is going to small claims court. And as long as your claim is for under $7,500 in damages, you can have that court case heard in small claims court. And a number of our listeners have done that, and a number of our listeners have prevailed in small claims court.
Yeah, and that is an option. I'm disappointed too in credit card companies. It's worth saying, because basically, in most cases I've heard about, if the airline has replied, no, the customer's not entitled to a refund, just a voucher, the credit card company has said, hey, we're siding with the merchant in this case, and so they haven't been real helpful to people. And not investigated what the truth is of whether the person is really entitled to a refund or not.
Now there's an internal battle being fought within airlines to try to figure out how to price your ticket. We're seeing airline tickets all over the board in terms of pricing because there's no way to figure out demand in the traditional way. There's no way to figure out traveler behavior in the traditional way. And we're looking at airfares like, you know, $47 round-trip tickets from L.A. to Austin on American Airlines, or a New York to L.A. Transcon round trip for like $160. It's unheard of. And then I looked at a trip the other day from New York to London. They wanted $6,000. I'm like, you can't be serious. Scott, there's no reasoning here anymore.
No, there is no reasoning. And this is really kind of fascinating because, you know, airlines have spent millions and millions of dollars on sophisticated artificial intelligence systems that predict demand for tickets. So that I always sort of feel like when I start searching for a ticket, the airline knows I'm going to want to go to Cleveland on the third Tuesday of October, and they price accordingly, and that means going higher. The whole game for airlines is you got to fill some seats with cheap fare people, but you don't want to fill too many. So you have to be able to predict what the demand is going to be closer to departure, and that's what business travelers are going to pay. They can't predict anything now, and it's really because all those systems are based on historical data. They do know what demand is for the flight to Cleveland on the third Tuesday of October at 2 p.m. But they know that because of what happened last year and the year before and 3 years before that. And all that is out the window. So the pricing systems are basically defunct. And what's also fascinating about it is that next year, the history of this year is going to be completely irrelevant. And so there again, they're going to have a difficult time pricing. And you do see these crazy, ridiculous prices. I've also seen the other extreme where this is kind of fascinating. You see the same price for a flight now and in October and November and March and April and June, and the system is doing absolutely no yield management on it. It's just the same price from now and forever. And that's a sort of a equal sign of the dysfunctioning of all the pricing systems.
And for the foreseeable future, at least through next May, that's going to continue, I guess.
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, there are obviously humans behind this. What you're seeing in pricing, airlines are really struggling right now with the question of, hey, should we offer low fares? Because you use low fares to stimulate demand. But can you really, in this environment, stimulate demand? Somebody who's afraid of flying, they're probably equally afraid at $250 as they are at $50. So what's the point of offering $50? You know that there's a certain number of people, and many of them are first responders or healthcare workers or people involved in healthcare somehow. There's a certain number of people who have to travel. And so should you treat them like business travelers and charge them high prices? Are you going to be accused of price gouging if you do that? Most airlines have sort of settled into, well, let's offer a decent fare, $100, $200, $300, no more, and get a decent price out of the people who are traveling, and not worry about trying to offer great sales to get people flying again. That'll come later, offering really high fares. Now, 6,000 to London, I mean, basically they don't want passengers. They're flying those trips for cargo only. And so what's really going to be interesting is if we get to vaccine treatment, all that, what airlines are going to do to start enticing people to come back and travel. And that's when I think you'll see the really great bargains.
But for the moment, in terms of pricing, I think it's safe to say the airlines are flying somewhat blind.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the industry that pioneers pricing in so many ways and frustrates consumers with prices that change, five times a day, 12 times a day. People get, really crazed when they're shopping and the price suddenly jumps up and all that.
I'll give you a story that happened to me. I mentioned the airfare from New York to Los Angeles at about $180 or $170 round trip. I wanted to stay an extra day, so I called the airline and said, can I move it back a day? And they said, sure, that'll be a $200 change fee. I said, your airfare is $79. Your airfare is $79. Wake up. Are you kidding? I failed math in high school, but I can do that kind of arithmetic. And, I just said, you know what? Then great. I'll just make a new reservation for $79. Duh.
My thanks to Scott. Right now in New York alone, more than 1,000 restaurants have closed permanently. And the number of closings grows by the day. And this is happening all over the country. I talked with journalist and Food Network judge Troy Johnson to get his take on how bad it's really been, how bad it is, and what lies ahead.
In New York City, where I live, there are 1,000 restaurants that have closed that are never going to reopen. Those are just the ones that are not going to reopen. The other ones, the jury's out. We don't know. We're seeing this across the country. We're seeing an unemployment level in the travel sector of about 51%, with one-third of those jobs maybe never returning. And joining me now, our resident food expert, judge on the Food Network, and a regular on our show on PBS called The Travel Detective, Troy Johnson. Troy, in your travels around the country, I mean, the desperation right now is palpable, because you can't fix the floor plan of enough restaurants to make it work based on what the health protocols require.
Yeah, it's the ultimate irony of all of this. And my industry and my friends in the restaurant industry have been crushed so hard. They've been crushed by the very thing that they bring to us. They brought people together in an age of isolation, an age when we're all on our phones, when they were all, you know, just grabbing things to go, and we're not talking to anybody. I mean, we really have become sort of we go from one box to the next. We go from home, we go to work, we don't go out and really convene. That's what restaurants did. They brought us together, and unfortunately, that was exactly what the problem was when COVID-19 hit. You know, and the whole reason you go is to celebrate, to high-five, to hug, to cheers, and everything else, and that's why they got so hit.
You know, it's the whole concept of community, and I look back over the last, 6 or 7 months, and I'm saying, okay, what am I not spending money on now? Mm-hmm. Well, there are certain things I'm not spending on money now that I don't worry about, like, I have no dry cleaning bills anymore, right?
I can tell. I'm just kidding.
Hey, this is radio, thank God. No, but the bottom line is I'm not wearing a jacket and tie, mm-hmm. right? You know, here's Brooks Brothers going out of business because nobody's buying those kinds of clothes. No dry cleaning bills. I get that. But then I used to eat out 3 nights, maybe 4 nights a week, mm-hmm. wherever I was traveling in the world, right? Now, in the last 7 months, I may have had a restaurant meal under different conditions, as you know, maybe 5 times. Uh-huh. So I'm eating at home. And you look at this and you go, for the first time in recent memory, Americans' kitchens, right, in our own homes, are finally being used. They were underutilized. Uh-huh. But it wasn't what we were used to doing.
No, are you kidding me? I'm not used to doing that many dishes. I've realized that the real value of American restaurants is having somebody else do your dishes for you, because
this just dawned on you?
I'm suffering. I am. I look. I'm like, how? My daughter just ate one bowl of cereal. How did she use 9 bowls? You know, I don't get it. You know, the thing about the restaurant industry is that in San Diego especially, is that they're living right now on the PPP money and sunshine. Thank God for our industry. We have more days of sunshine than most
in San Diego.
In San Diego.
But in New York, here's what's going on. It's one thing to be able to get a special provision from the mayor to be able to eat outside on the sidewalk or in parking lots until October, November, and December roll around.
Right.
There's your revenue gone because there's no indoor dining.
Yeah, the industry needs a bailout on every single level. They need help from the landlords to give them, you know, lease exceptions. And then the landlords need help from the banks, and the banks need help from the government. It's absolutely going to be a group effort to save the industry. There are estimates between 35% and 85% of restaurants, independent restaurants, will go out. And the problem here, Peter, is that the restaurants that are going to go out are not the chain restaurants. We've seen some chain restaurants go out. The California Pizza Kitchen went out. You're going to see some of that.
Never to come back?
They filed for bankruptcy. You know, so I mean, that is, you're going to see some of that, you know, but you're going to see mostly mom and pops who don't have the financial largesse behind them and investors to be able to survive something like this economic dark winter.
Exactly. You
know? Yeah, so it's going to be brutal. But the good things that you're going to see are a few things.
Before we get to the good things,
okay,
let's talk about some of the brands. Mm-hmm. You talk about the chains, right? Mm-hmm. You see retail going out.
Yeah.
I mean, in New York City, 1 out of every 2 stores on Madison Avenue is closed and not coming back. Mm-hmm. That's outrageous, right? But it's true.
Yeah.
And then some of the other brands that we know, don't laugh. I mean, you look at the airport retail food, they're not coming back. You know, what's happening to Cinnabon?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I haven't had one in a long time.
But they smell delicious.
Oh, my God. Lethal. But I mean, right? Or Krispy Kreme or, mm-hmm. or things that we used to take for granted. Where are they? Where'd they go? Where is the turnaround? Because we already can surmise that 1/3 of those jobs are not going to come back. At least 1/3 of those restaurants are not coming back. Now, I mentioned 1,000 restaurants in New York closing and never coming back. There are 19,000 restaurants in New York, or I should say now 18,000. but that's still a huge hit.
Yeah, it's going to be a massive, it's going to be massive sloughing of the entire industry. It's a devastation of it. That industry more so than almost anyone's, except for possibly live music venues, you know, and event spaces and that sort of thing. Here's the good things that are going to come out of this. That I've been talking with restaurateurs every single day since this started. You know, a few of the good things are this. The laws that are being momentarily changed are going to be permanent. You know, a lot of like alcohol to go. You know, a lot of states did not allow.
Oh, great for states where people drive in their cars.
Right. Yeah. Well, but we can be responsible and we can take some sort of ride sharing, you know, and take cocktails.
Or yeah, we could, but we,
Yeah. So, I mean, but that allows restaurants to make a little bit more income that they never had because they don't make money on food. They make money on alcohol. They make money on that bottle of wine. They make money on that cocktail that they spent, you know, months researching, you know, what really pays the bills in a restaurant. That sort of thing is going to probably be permanent in California. We'll
so
see.
Liquor laws are going to have to be changed.
Liquor laws are most likely going to be changed. Also, what you're going to get is you're going to get a taking...
And that's not California. That's U.S.
That will probably be across the U.S. I mean, it's usually a state-by-state measure, but you know, I would see a lot of states are going to make that change permanent in an effort to help the restaurants because this isn't a month-long thing. When this
By the way, if they don't change it across the U.S.,
yeah,
you'll see people doing what they used to do in the old days, crossing state lines to go get something to drink.
Absolutely. You know, and this is, I mean, this is not going to be a few months thing. Even when we have a vaccine, even when we think that it's over, the reverberation of the economic impact on the restaurant industry is going to last for years for them to take back. So they got to keep some of those things.
Okay. Now, we've seen a number of other developments during COVID-19. Menus being simplified, right? Fewer items on the bill.
Absolutely.
Right? Fewer items available for delivery just because of the nature of the food itself. Is that going to change?
That's going to be. Most of the chefs that I've talked to have said that while this is one of the worst things that it could ever have ever happened to them, it also made them streamline their businesses. And it also made them figure out what was cost effective, what was, you know, a new way of doing business. Some of the places that would have never thought about doing takeout to go now have realized that, no, we can do this and we can make some meals that actually carry pretty well and have this be an existing business plan for us along with our dine-in once it all comes back.
Okay, now I got to talk about the big bad elephant in the room, and that is the delivery service markup.
Oh my God.
Right? This is killing restaurants.
Absolutely killing restaurants.
Right? I mean, I've talked to restaurateurs who are telling me that the markup is like 30% in some cases for the delivery fees that they're paying for these guys, to, you know, the Grubhubs and all those guys delivering. Where do you find the solution there now?
Now, there is not a solution except for in the immediate term. And a lot of cities are doing this. Portland's done this. New York's done this. San Francisco's done this. LA's done this. The city councils have voted to put momentary caps on how much of a percentage those third-party delivery apps, Grubhub, Uber Eats, Postmates, how much they can charge the restaurateur. Because you're right, Peter. It's 25 to 30%. When you're talking about a restaurant
but
that makes...
that's your profit. That's your profit.
They only make... this restaurant only makes 7% profit margin on any sale. Then that third-party delivery app's taken 30. So the city councils have stepped in and said you cannot charge more than 10 or 15. That's got to happen in the short term. And then in the long term...
That explains to me why this. I see so many signs in restaurants saying, please call us directly.
Do not use third-party delivery apps. And I apologize if they can't make money, if they have to figure out a different way to make money, because you cannot charge a restaurateur, especially during a pandemic, 25 to 30% of their profits on every single order. It is absolutely killing them in a time of dire need. You know, so please go directly through the restaurant or call, you know, through the website, call them, pick up, get them.
Through the restaurant's own website.
Own website, exactly. So, I mean, the third-party delivery apps need to go. And the last part that's going to be a silver lining is that you're going to get these cities taken back for the people and not cars. San Diego, where I live, we have a big problem with that. We've been built for car culture and not so much for walking and public promenades and things like that. Now you see, in order to survive, they've let the restaurants spill out in the streets and create these outdoor dining spaces. Those are going to stay. They're going to start shutting down a lot of streets, maybe permanently. They've been talking about doing
We're shutting them down in New York.
Yeah, you know, and giving it back to the people. We've seen time and time again that when you take public space back from cars and give it to people, it is a win-win, and it makes everybody feel better about their city.
But people have to become better drivers because we've had a couple of accidents in New York where cars are crashing into diners.
Yeah. I've seen the way people drive in San Diego, and it's not encouraging, let's just say.
No.
That. Yeah.
No, they're going to have to change liquor laws. They're going to have to change traffic flow, right?
Yeah.
And they're going to have to change the way we do delivery because, as you say, that markup is killing the owners.
Yeah, and it's going to absolutely revolutionize the way that they do business at a core molecular level.
Right. And maybe in New York I can order a grilled cheese that's not $32. What do you think?
I wouldn't get my hopes up on that one, Peter. It's New York.
My thanks to Troy Johnson, to Scott McCartney, and to Keith Barr. And my thanks to you for listening to this Ion Travel podcast. For more conversations with the world's leaders in travel, as well as answers to your travel questions, be sure to listen, rate, and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. For continuous updates on breaking travel news, log on to petergreenberg.com.
If you like Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcast starting May 8th. Access episodes early and ad-free with 48 Hours Plus on Apple Podcasts starting May 1st.